Hey folks, today's episode is brought to you by Red Hen Press, the largest and oldest nonprofit independent publishing company in Los Angeles. Red Hen Press publishes poetry, creative nonfiction, memoirs, and fiction, including Unseen City by Amy Sherin, the latest Nervous Breakdown book club selection. Red Hen Press has also published best-selling work by Steve Almond, also a guest on this program in the past. Check out episode 513 for his discussion on Bad Stories, an in-depth look at how America came to elect Donald Trump. They've also published work by Fear of Flying author Erica Jong and Erasure author Percival Everett. Red Hen Press focuses on diversity in publishing, offering 10 annual publication awards, and they accept unagented submissions of manuscripts. For more information, visit redhen.org. And best of all, get 40% off your order for a limited time using the offer code OTHERPPL. Over at http://shop.aer.io/red_hen_press. Hey, everybody, how are you? What's happening to you? What's happening out there? My name is Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. It's good to be with you. And it's good to breathe. The air has reverted to some semblance of normal here in California, or at least where I am. I can breathe again, and I'm happy about that. Amy Sherin is my guest. She has a new novel out called Unseen City, available now from Red Hen Press. Unseen City is the official September pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. TheNervousBreakdown.com is my online culture magazine and literary community. It has its own monthly book club and has had one for the past decade. If you want to sign up for the book club, just go to TheNervousBreakdown.com. Amy Sherin is the author of multiple books. Her other novels include The Mermaid of Brooklyn and another one called How Far is the Ocean from Here? Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Slate, Poets and Writers, The Millions, and other publications. She's a senior editor at Forge and the New York fiction editor for Joyland Magazine. So, very pleased to have Amy on the program. We had a good time, and that is coming up. I do have some quick orders of business. First of all, just a reminder that Other People gear is available. You can get a t-shirt, super soft, a sweatshirt, a tank top. Just go to otherppl.com, click on the t-shirt in the left sidebar. I also want to remind you that I am blogging on a daily basis in a tediously maximal and self-revealing way over at bradpocalypse.blogspot.com. That is happening between now, or it started back on September 8th, I believe, and I'm going to go until Inauguration Day. The blog is called Notes from the Fall, and you can read that at bradpocalypse.blogspot.com. Finally, don't forget, if you're out there listening and you want to send in a photo of where you are, just DM the show. Just DM the photo over at Twitter, at OtherPPL, or on Instagram. You can also email me the photo at letters@otherppl.com, letters@otherppl.com. Let us know where you listen. It's a cool thing. Check out the show's Instagram, and you can see photos of where other listeners are listening. All right? So Amy Sherin is my guest. Her new novel, Unseen City, available now from Red Hen Press. An absolute delight talking with her, and I'm pleased to share this conversation with you now. This is the official September pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club, Unseen City. Here she is, folks. This is Amy Sherin.
There's plenty of terrible things about living in a dense urban environment, but this, you know, the way you're sort of forced to encounter all of your neighbors and get to know them and the kind of community that can sort of be created out of nowhere is actually really lovely. And I, you know, I'm not from here. My family's not around here. So I don't know. I feel like the people who water my plants when I'm out of town and my kids' emergency contacts, like it's all like an invented community that that I forced to be my community by chatting I don't know.
But the question is, like, sometimes somebody, like, if you've got stuff to do, like, you're in a hurry. Like, I find myself, if I'm in a hurry and I'm like racing, I'm walking out of the house and I'm going somewhere, and then like my neighbor's there.
Right.
Sometimes he'll want to chat, and I'll be like, I don't want to be
Totally.
rude, but I got to go. And like, I never know how to handle that transaction. Like, how to
Aww.
quickly like get myself out of it.
Yeah, I understand that. Well, that is also another great thing about New York City is that also everyone's slightly rude. So I feel like if you have an encounter where you're just kind of rude, nobody, it doesn't faze anybody. You're just like, I gotta go. And they're like, fine. I don't know. I'm from the Midwest originally, and I feel like if you tried to pull that in the Midwest, people would be like, are you okay? What's, I don't know. Then they'd call your mom, be like, Amy seemed really stressed out. Is she okay? And here, nobody cares. So I think. Or maybe when I'm in a hurry, I offend everyone and they hate my guts.
I think being like blunt in some contexts is good, like that. You know, like I like not being rigid, but like I would love to talk,
Yeah.
but I gotta go. People get that.
Yeah. I think that's like New York polite, which people who are from other places get confused about it and they think that New Yorkers are being rude. But I feel like actually saying, vocalizing your needs is actually quite a kindness, I think.
So you've lived there how long again? What is it?
Like 15, almost 16 years.
So,
Yeah.
and I was thinking about that because I've lived in Los Angeles close to that long, a little bit longer, but
Oh.
I'm from the Midwest originally as well, and this is my adopted hometown. I think when you've lived someplace 15 plus years, you can start to call it your hometown. I think, like, I don't know what the cutoff is, but you're getting
Yeah, what
close.
is the cutoff? I don't think of myself as a New Yorker, but I don't know. Wait, where are you from in the Midwest? Have we discussed this?
No, Milwaukee and Indiana. I split time when I was a kid.
Oh, that's legit Midwest.
It's hardcore Midwest, I feel
That's
like.
hardcore.
But the point that I want to make with respect to Unseen City is, and I could be wrong on this, but I feel you having lived in Brooklyn, in this book, becoming obviously curious about the city's history, like Brooklyn's history in particular. And I've been feeling the same way about Los Angeles, maybe particularly so lately. I don't know if it's this amount of time I've lived here where suddenly it's like, wait, what the fuck happened here? Like what am I, what, like, I think maybe the first 10 or 15 years you're living someplace, you're just kind of getting to know it at surface level. And then once you maybe get a firm handle on that, you start to want to know what you're standing on and what was here before and who was here before. Is that an accurate like
Yeah.
depiction of what you went through as you were kind of like this idea was germinating for your novel?
Yeah, that's such a good analysis of it because I hadn't really thought about why, I became more interested in the history of the city, but I think that's exactly right. Yeah, I think at first you're just kind of getting your bearings. And then also it probably has to do with the sort of stage of life that we're in. Like we're getting I feel like if I can assume that we're maybe about the same age, we're sort of getting to that. We're inching towards the genealogy stage. You know what I mean? Where all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, let me look into my family's past. And I feel like this is it's a related city stage where you sort of start to become curious. And I think it has to do too with I mean, I really started thinking about this book. It took a long time to write, and I started writing it and researching it in 2013. And my then husband and I were looking for a house. We sort of had this idea like maybe we could buy a house in Brooklyn, which turned out to not be a true thing, but it was a nice idea we had for a while. And it was like part of it was going in a lot of spaces and thinking about setting down roots somewhere and thinking about, when you're sort of thinking, okay, I'm going to be a little less transient in the city. I'm going to find my little corner of it. And thinking so much about different neighborhoods, what it means to live in a neighborhood, what it means to buy property somewhere, or how you're choosing to set down your roots in that city. And I think for me, that made me start thinking about the history and what was here before and my place in it. And then not having grown up here, there's a lot of city history that I just didn't know. So it was a really, for me, a really fun way to kind of dive in.
So let's talk about Weeksville, because that was something that was new to me. I'm assuming it was new to you, at least when you stumbled upon it and started to, I guess, build it into your narrative. But I think to the casual listener, particularly those who are outside of the New York metropolitan area, they probably wouldn't know what Weeksville is.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't. And I think a lot of particularly white people in the city don't, because it's sort of an interesting kind of hidden chapter of history. Yeah, I kind of stumbled upon it. I knew I wanted to have these dual narratives in the book and have a contemporary story where there was a haunted house. And I knew I wanted the house to be a part of New York City history and also have the book also tell the story of the house's past. But I hadn't quite, you know, dug into what that sort of past, the historical layer of the book was going to be. And I started doing all this research, and as I think every historian or amateur historian already knew, you kind of can't really scratch the surface of American history or New York City history without getting to, you know, a story about race and racism and sort of the country's unresolved grief, which it's so interesting to me that this book is coming out this year in American history. But anyway, so Weeksville. So as soon as I read about all of these different sort of chapters of Brooklyn history, and as soon as I read about Weeksville, I thought, oh God, it's so fascinating, because it was a farming village, this kind of almost utopian community. It was its own town in what is now Brooklyn. And it was founded in 1838, you know, before the Civil War, by free landowning African Americans. And it was this community full of very educated people. There were churches, there were schools, there was an old age home, there was cemeteries, and their own newspaper. A lot of the people who lived there kept journals, which weren't found until later. And of course, at the contemporary New York City media portrayed it as this wild, you know, den of iniquity, although its own records show that it was actually just like a very nice little quiet farm town. And then it just eventually became kind of subsumed by Brooklyn as Brooklyn sort of grew up around it. And a lot of the, But some of the original farmhouses are still there, but they're just now in these, you know, kind of gritty Brooklyn streets. It was rediscovered. And part of what I love about it is the story of the rediscovery of it. It just sort of, you know, got, you know, Brooklyn sort of built up all around it. And then in the 1960s, this historian named James Hurley, he was reading an old history of Brooklyn and sort of thought, wait a minute, it sounds like this community of Weeksville was right here in what is now sort of the Crown Heights Bed-Stuy neighborhood. And apparently he had a friend with a prop plane, and this was a thing that you could do in 1960s. Brooklyn was just fly your little plane around over neighborhoods looking for it. And they found these houses that were off the city grid. And there were these old, you know, wood frame houses that looked like farmhouses. But the fact that they were off the grid made them think, okay, this must be it. It's clearly, you know, existing on a different map than what has been overlaid. And then he did all this research and had all of these school children and other just neighborhood people and amateur historians and archaeologists do all of this work to discover and to then restore these houses. And now the Weeksville Heritage Society has this beautiful plot of land. Like when you go there, you just turn a corner and it's like you're in the past on this beautiful farm. It's it's a very magical feeling place. And they have these three original houses, and now there's like a big, beautiful visitor center and museum. And they helped me do a lot of research for the book too. But yeah, it's just such an interesting history. Sorry, I get really excited about it, and I feel like I just talked for 100 years. But
no, I get it. I get it. And you know, it also brought to mind for me Robert Moses, the famous New York City planner, the subject of Robert Caro's book, yeah. The Power Broker. And I was thinking of all these neighborhoods, mostly working class neighborhoods, people of color living there, and these, massive like city works projects that Moses undertook just wiped these neighborhoods off the map. So yeah. If you're driving on a freeway in and around New York City, it's likely you might be driving straight through somebody's old home. And it's kind of heartbreaking because, these places were vibrant, close-knit communities, and they just didn't have the resources to overcome this guy's power and sort of menace, and kind of monomaniacal desire to pave and develop and make friendly for automobiles the city of New York. So it's not exactly the same thing right. That happened to Weeksville, but it's the same general idea, the way, there could be like entire places that are filled with life one moment, and within a year even, they can be gone forever.
Yeah, yeah. I was just actually read a really interesting article in the publication Gen, which is part of Medium, which I work for. But it was about gentrification and sort of how the pandemic might be speeding up gentrification, and how there's this scholar quote in the article talking about how, it's not just that people are losing their jobs and have to move out of their neighborhoods. It's part of this really deeply ingrained story and pattern in the United States of America, where disenfranchised people are pushed out of their spaces and their homes. And it's just such a sort of psychological trauma. Your home is so important to you, and you're in a country where we make so much of land and who has what land, and the sort of constant process of pushing people off their land. It's just fascinating.
Yeah, there's so many. I mean, like, we could talk for an entire hour about all the different issues related to urban planning and how people are housed, especially living in big cities like mm-hmm. we do. I mean, these things are so front of mind for me in Los Angeles. I'm sure it's the same in New York, but
I bet.
It's coming to a head sooner than later, like how we're going to deal with housing prices and how we're going to deal with climate change and how we're going to have to rezone and all the rest. I think without getting too deep into the weeds on it, but what happens all too often when they have these kinds of debates in big cities is that everybody's sort of all for affordable housing and multi-unit housing and all this stuff, as long as it's not in their neighborhood. You know what I'm saying?
It's right. Like,
just don't do it here.
Yeah.
Do it someplace else and we're good. But if you do it in my backyard, there's going to be an issue. And so that's why it always gets jammed up in the legislative process.
Yeah. And there's so much coded speech about it, which to me, I was thinking about real estate, looking at real estate, and I guess it was around the same time that my kids were starting public school. And I became aware of all the coded ways that people talk about neighborhoods and parts of the city, and sort of that, like, oh, well, you can't go to that neighborhood because the schools, and sometimes it means the schools, and sometimes that just means, you'll be the only white person there and you don't want to do that. Or, I don't know, it's so insidious the way it shapes even, the language and the way that we move around the city. And and it's interesting because, for as long as I've been here, I do sort of always slightly feel like an outsider, which I feel like makes me more watchful of things. And more, for some reason, I'm perpetually surprised by New York City. I don't know. Like, when I had that realization, I was like, oh, wait. We can't buy a house, but I know all these people who are artists who bought houses that are really nice. Hold on a second. I don't think they bought their own houses. Like, everything is perpetually a surprise to me. So maybe it means I have to think it through a little more.
I feel like we're getting off topic a bit, but just that the difference in terms of like what people earn, you know, like, because like you're saying, you look around at housing prices or you look around at what it costs to live in New York City and it's like,
right,
who the fuck can afford this? Like who yeah. is living in these places? Who's buying these like loft apartments for $7 million? And it's just, it's hard to imagine anybody can do it. I guess a lot of it is foreign money or it's, you know, wealth transfer generationally. And then maybe there's just some like investment bankers who hit it big. I mean, what's the,
well, maybe they're pirates. Maybe there's like some secret thing that we don't even know about. I feel like there's been a lot of sort of New York City gallows humor lately. Cause you know, the sort of the zeitgeisty conversation about New York City's dead and it was just declared an anarchist state or something, which I feel like everyone I know was like, awesome.
Right.
Yeah, way to make us sound so cool, you guys. Thank you. But I do feel like I'm having that conversation with friends a lot. Where we're like, wow, is New York City about to get real weird? And could that be awesome in a way? Like, totally get that that's a very privileged point of view. But I do feel like I'm hearing a lot of that conversation where people are like, hold on, I think maybe, you know, artists really are going to be able to buy lofts again in a couple of years. And like, it's not going to be pretty around us, but there might be some benefit to what's about to happen to the city. Maybe.
I've also heard like darker takes where it's like, oh my God, if everybody flees the city and the price, right. you know, nobody's renting and the housing prices drop dramatically, then all of these like holding companies and investment banks and whatever are going to come in and just buy up all the real estate and wait for the market to go back up and then rent it out.
Yeah, that's less fun.
Way less fun.
I'm like, just, it's like everything's a Chase Bank. You're yeah, like, aw.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was going to be artists.
I want to talk to you about the occult because...
Oh, always want to talk about that.
Yeah. But I mean, is that the right... Am I using that term correctly when it comes to ghosts and stuff? That's the occult, right? Or just like the supernatural maybe might be the best.
Supernatural. Yeah.
You're concerned with this as well in your book and... You're sort of braiding together all these different strands. And I'm just curious to know, like, have you seen a ghost? Is this something you've been fascinated with for a long time? Did you see a ghost? And was this something that, like, prompted you to, you know, weave it into your fiction?
Good question. Am I a ghost? Are we all ghosts? We can get there. You know, I think that I'm like a like Fox Mulder ghost person. Like I want to believe. I love the idea of it, actually. I mean, really, I love the idea that there's another. I don't know. It makes sense to me that you can't just be alive or dead, and that there would be kind of something in between. Narratively, it's so useful to have that in between space. There's a ghost in the book who, and I always wanted her to be like a solid ghost. It's not a figment of anyone's imagination. It's not like a Henry James Turn of the Screw. Is it or isn't it really a ghost? Like I love a solid ghost. And she has a story to tell, and eventually tells it. And I was just thinking so much about how sort of largely about kind of America as a haunted house and New York City as a haunted house and how there's all of these, like we were just talking about, all of these sort of buried layers of history that surely have some resonance and stories to still tell. Boringly, I really have not had an experience with a ghost, sadly. But I love the idea so much. But I will say, okay, because I know you're a dog person, right?
Correct, so, yes.
So maybe you will not think this is the silliest. But I used to have a dog. And when the dog died, so we had the dog was old and sick and dying. And we had her put down in our apartment. And I just, especially the next few days, I really... totally felt like she was still there. You know, you just felt some kind of presence. And in the places where she would often be laying down, it's like you could sort of feel something there. And I remember thinking, all right, she's a dog. And like, I don't know, not the smartest dog. I don't know if your brain power affects how powerful you are as a ghost. I don't really know how it works. But But I just remember thinking, if I feel this sort of presence, this shadowy something here, just for a couple days after this stupid, awesome old dog died, what if, you know, what if it was a person? Maybe there's more. Maybe they stick around more.
And I always thought too, like, my conception of how this works is that, like, if you have unfinished business,
right,
or if you die in some state of, like, particular attachment or concern about a situation or a person in your life or something, that maybe you might linger in that kind of, like, transitional state or Bardo state or whatever you call it longer.
Right. Yes. I was just going to say, did you read Lincoln and the Bardo?
Part of it. Yeah. Not all of it. This is very common for me, by the way. I do this all the time. Like, I'll be flipping through. I was probably in a bookstore. It stood there for like 45 minutes or something.
I find that shocking. I can't believe you just said that.
Why?
That's so liberating, just to put down a book if you're not wanting to finish it.
I mean, I do want to finish it. That's the weird thing. I just have so I have so many books, Amy. You have no idea how many. I get like I get like 4 books a day.
That's really funny. Lincoln and the Bardo, the first time I started reading it, I immediately put it down and thought, I cannot handle this. What is this? And then the next time I picked it up, you know, it's just, it has to be the right book at the right time. And I couldn't put it down. And it's a really quick read. But for people who haven't read it, it's George Saunders' novel. Is it a novel? I don't know. But it's almost written like a play. It's all these voices. And it's all of these spirits who are lingering in this in-between state. They're dead. They don't want to admit they're dead, and they haven't gone to, essentially, they never name it, I don't think, but it's like the good place. And they're sort of stuck in this in-between state. And I love the conversations that they have amongst themselves. Is so fascinating. Great. And it feels so, it's very funny, the book, but it also feels so sort of psychologically real that it would take you a while to get used to this idea. You know, change is really hard. Imagine that. That's a big change.
Making the transition to like the netherworld or whatever.
That's right. Take your time, guys.
Yeah, it's hard enough it's hard enough to like switch neighborhoods in Brooklyn, let alone.
That's right. Yeah. I just moved like half a mile and it took me a while to get used to it. I'm not even dead.
So let's talk about death a little bit more, because grief is another, it's another theme. Your heroine, yeah. Meg Reese, am I pronouncing that right? It's Reese, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So is that like a nod to Jean Reese, or is that, or Jean Reese or whatever?
Yes, exactly.
Oh. Okay.
That's right. She's like, this character's sort of, she's kind of like comprised in her own life and in the narrative of the book of different characters from books, you know, and part of that is how she constructs her own life. And then part of that is how I conceived her in my brain.
Got it. Yeah. And yes, so, and she's grieving the loss of her sister, Kate.
Right.
Which is like a through line in the book. And I guess like it all makes sense, you know, ghost stories, a lost sister, like there are these pieces coming together. This is obviously on your mind. You know, I guess maybe it's at our age, as you mentioned earlier, I don't know, I'm 45. I think you're a little younger than I am, but
we're close to death, man.
Well, it's like the old joke, you know, I want to say this is a Louis C.K. joke. So apologies for quoting it, because I know he's persona non grata, but he was talking about like once you get past like a certain age, like it's no longer tragic if you die, you know, like it's getting to the point where like no one would be like, there'd be like no candlelight vigil.
He was so young.
Yeah, no, it would just be like, oh, he died, you know? Oh, well, that's what happens to people.
I don't think
like
you're
him.
There yet,
I'm getting there, you know?
And people like it.
So I think that not maybe, of course you start to think more about death the older you get, because you know it's coming. And I've also lost a lot of people in my life. I think the longer you live, you know, you're obviously going to lose people. Have you been dealing with a loss? Was there a loss in your life that sort of instigated this? Or was it just kind of like a general interest and fascination with loss and death and grief?
This is great. This is like therapy. Okay. Thank you for asking. I mean, I think part of it is being a parents, you all of a sudden think about how I don't know. Like, you create these lives, and that means that you also have created their deaths, which is a fun way to think about parenting, but it's true. And everything feels so much more dire and serious, and you feel so much more vulnerable to everything when you're a parent. And I think especially a parent of young children, as I was when I started writing this, like, they seem more, I don't know, solid now, my kids. But but also something I was thinking about a lot as I was writing this was my parents, who they, for whatever reason, because, you know, you just don't think about your parents as people until you're like 35 in my case, apparently. But my parents met in their 20s, and they had both just experienced a big loss. My mom's brother and my father's father died suddenly, and my parents were in their early 20s, and they met, and they said, you know, at some point I said, wait a minute, do you think that that bonded you together? And my mom said, yes, of course. It was like we were two lost souls finding each other, and which is so sweet. And also, it's my parents. Gross, guys. But it really was, you know, it made me think a lot about, you know, especially when you're young and you've experienced sort of a brutal loss like that, most of the people in your life don't understand. They just haven't been through something like that. So I loved the idea of writing about two characters who kind of come together because they have each experienced a big loss, like Meg and this guy Ellis that she meets, and they sort of come together in that way. And it seemed like a sort of, that was sort of the like person size story of it. And it seemed to me like the stand in for sort of the country size story of, you know, how do we deal with all this unresolved grief and trauma that just is, you know, life in America.
It's such a relevant question. It's on my mind a lot. And I've talked about it with guests on this show before where, you know, first of all, you've got to see it all. You've got to recognize that the grief exists and that the injustice has existed and continues to exist. And you sort of have to see the problem clearly. And then the question is like, what to do about it? And right. Then the question beyond that for me is like, how are we going to know when we get there? Like, what's the evidence procedure? Like, how are we going to get healed for real? Yeah. You know, is it even possible?
Yeah. It's like all of America goes to therapy, and the therapist is like, great news, guys. We figured it out. You're okay now.
You're done. I mean,
you're right. All done. You're fixed. I do think, like, in the book, I feel like for my characters, and they don't, you know, get it all figured out, but an answer ends up being sort of connecting with each other and connecting and hearing each other's stories and sort of connecting across difference. And maybe that's sort of the person-sized version that we can pursue. Is just, I don't know. Is that such a soft answer? Just trying to listen and connect to people. But I do feel like we have to do more now than just listen to people, but that's part of it.
Yeah, I think, like, I've been going back and forth too. I think it's like a toggling between like the personal and sort of taking care of your own house, you know, making sure that you're doing personal right. work to be better and to understand these things and all that. And then there's also like the more macro, like legislative level, where there's got to be, that's where there's got to be real change. It has to happen in the halls of power in order for it to be sweeping enough to really make a dent.
Yeah, that's totally right. And that's so hard. I mean, this is a particularly, I feel like, hard moment for, you know, just feeling a little bit hopeless in the face of everything that's happening. And like, we're talking, you know, I guess just a couple of days after Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. And I feel like there's been this sort of collective outpouring in my bubble anyway of, just people feeling like, oh my God, this is also helpless. And I'm just one person. What can I do? You know, I don't know, make some phone calls. I can.
Just before I came on the line with you, I gave away like more of our money to like every single like swing Senate that's rate. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like that's what I keep doing. I just keep giving our money away. I'm just like, okay.
I think that's the right thing to do. I think that's the most helpful. It's so hard to know what to do as just a person.
Well, have you ever considered running for office, Amy?
No. You know, it's funny. I was just having this conversation with a friend where we were talking about this weekend. She texted me. She said, I know AOC said no more brunch. We can't have brunch anymore. We have to do the hard work, but I really want to have brunch. And I was like, oh, me too. I was like, I wish I was an AOC where I was just, you know, I have so much admiration for those people who, you know, are just dedicating their lives to making change. I do also think that just there's something important about matching, just as a person in the world, about matching your personality and energy type and the things that you're good at with the things that you actually do. Like, I do not think I'd be a good politician, but what about you? Have you ever thought about it?
Yeah, I have, if I'm being honest. Like, I mean, but not in any kind of like serious, like actionable way. It's just like, maybe I could be like the alderman or the city council person. Like my dreams were very modest, I think, politically. I was never thinking of myself as like a senator or something, but I'm just thinking about how can I actually impact things and be a force for change. But then those kinds of like mental conversations quickly peter out because I really have very low confidence that I could get elected. Maybe that's misplaced, but like my biography just doesn't fit. Like it's always like somebody who went to Harvard Law School or like studied city planning at MIT or some shit. And I'm like a podcaster who wrote a couple books. You know, like
I would not describe you as a podcaster who wrote a couple books. First of all, I think you need some personal branding.
I'm a literary media titan.
You're media mogul is how I would describe you. Okay. And I mean this in a good way. I think that you totally could do something like that. Like you, I mean, you're what the councilman chief of the nervous breakdown. That's no joke.
That's right.
And I actually think that super local politics are incredibly important. Really, you know, that's where actually a lot of change can happen quickly and, you know, not with a huge budget. And I think you should do it.
All right. That's it. I'm announcing my candidacy
a lawn
right now.
Sign. Great. Perfect. I can donate like $15, $20 today.
Great.
I'm willing to make that pledge. you're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Let's get on it. I feel like you need like a fun sign, a t-shirt. I feel like this is going to do itself, this campaign.
All right. Well, I'll keep pondering it. I want to have an impact. And like, I do think like the times that we're living in have made a lot of us more civic minded than we might otherwise have been, which I guess on a certain level is positive. You know, I hate that it took such tumult to make it happen, but here we are.
It's true. And I really do think it's an exciting moment. There are so many, you know, more women and people of color running for office, and especially in those really hyper local seats. I don't know. I think that's really important. It seems so like extroverty though. You should talk to so many people.
God, yeah. Can you imagine how fucking exhausting?
I would not. I'd be like, so I just did a campaign event, and now I need 3 days to just sit in a quiet room and recoup. And they'd be like, we hate you. You can't do that.
They say Abraham Lincoln was an introvert. We have had introverted presidents. I mean, I think you can be an introverted. Barack Obama was an introvert, or is an introvert.
I can see that.
You know, needs that like he used to work. I guess his like whole thing was he would stay up later than everybody and work into the night just to have that alone time. I get that.
Oh, buddy. Yeah, same. Except I'd do it early in the morning, but I feel that. Yeah.
So you've mentioned that you're from the Midwest. Whereabouts?
I'm from the suburbs of Chicago, which I feel like both is so much the Midwest and then is, you know, kind of its own little pocket of something.
I don't know. I mean, it feels, my sister lives in the suburbs of Chicago, and I feel like I've been there. It feels Midwest to me.
I feel like I have to be very careful not to say Chicago, because then people who are really from the city sort of sniff me out immediately. And they're like, sorry, do you mean Chicago? Or do you mean the suburbs? It's really, people feel really strongly about those lines, which I kind of get, but it's fine.
So the born suburbs. And raised, born and raised in suburban Chicago.
That's right. Well, I was born in Evanston, which is a sort of small city right outside of Chicago. Yeah. And then raised on the North Shore, which is actually, now that I've had time away from it, when I visit it, I recognize that it's quite lovely. Who knew? Didn't really clock that when I was growing up. But, you know, there's a lot of trees and ravines, and it's like a John Hughes movie. That's where all those movies take place.
Wait, were you in Glencoe? What was it called? What's the name of the suburb? Glen Ellen?
No way. Highland Park. Totally different.
Oh.
But, yeah, there's a scene in Weird Science where they drive down my street past my parents' house. Not to brag too much, but
damn,
I was very centered in like 90s teen media.
That's awesome. I grew up on those movies, like those Hughes movies, which they have I have a soft spot for them because I grew up on them, but on repeat viewings, I'm thinking of 16 Candles in particular. There's a lot of cringeworthy stuff in those movies.
Very problematic. Yeah. Ooh, and then the other claim to fame of my quiet, boring neighborhood where I grew up is that, you know, in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Cameron's house with the garage and it's like two blocks from my parents' house, which occasionally has impressed people. But
that's an awesome house.
It's really nice. Yeah. It's a. Yeah, and then we just walk by it and go, there's that house, yeah.
Is it still intact as it was?
It is. It's been actually undergoing some very serious renovations for the past few years. Apparently, like a huge glass box is a little hard to keep up in sort of Chicagoland winters. But yeah, I guess somebody lives there, and I don't know.
Okay. So, but it sounds like an all-American childhood. Am I misreading this? Like you're growing up in suburban, like John Hughes land, your parents are together, it sounds like.
Yeah, they still are. Can you believe it? They're sort of erstwhile hippies who met in California, in Oakland in the 70s, and then we're sort of like, oh, you know, it would be totally crazy and radical would be to move to the Midwest, I guess, and have children. So they're very creative people, and they're, I don't know that they're completely what people picture when you picture regular suburban parents, but they can pass for regular suburban parents.
Well, how so? You mean just because of their hippiness?
Right. Yeah. They're just like hippies who, they're both retired, and I'm pretty sure they just like jam out in guitar circles with their friends all the time, and take substances that are now legal. And
so your parents are stoners?
that's my running theory. I should, you know, I'm sure they're gonna listen to this and mom, dad, you guys are doing great, everything's fine, everything you're doing is perfect. I'm glad that you're having fun in your retirement and chilling with your homies.
Does your dad have a gray ponytail?
It's not. He doesn't have a ponytail.
He
does have like very luxurious hair.
That's nice.
And a beard. He's in like a group that I don't know if they're still, I guess in these times they're doing it over Zoom. He's in like a weekly Bob Dylan jam session. I don't know. They're just doing their thing.
Damn, that sounds cool. So what do they do? Like, are your parents writerly? Are either of them writerly?
Yeah. My dad always had, you know, a regular person job, but was always writing, and, you know, he's probably written 10 unpublished novels. And I was just talking about this in another interview about how, you know, when I started my MFA program, you know, all the other writers were like, aren't your parents so disappointed that you're here, you know, getting an MFA in fiction writing? It's so hard to explain to people. And I had to be like, no, my parents think it's great. They're so encouraging. you know, it's like you're trying to be a tortured artist and your parents are like, everything you do is so great, honey. We love it. Write another novel. I'm like, guys, come on, give me something to work with here.
Right. Quit being so understanding.
I know. Quit being so supportive of everything. Ugh.
So what kind of kid were you? What kind of kid was Amy Schoen?
What a funny question. I think I was pretty much always exactly how I am now, just reading a lot of books and in my own world. And I was really, really shy as a kid. And then somehow I got in middle school, I did some theater and I was super duper not a theater kid, but it really helped me be able to, you know, talk to human beings. And that was helpful. But it's funny because I feel like in pandemic life where I'm alone in my house and I work from home so often, I'm like, oh no, am I reverting? Am I going to lose my people skills? Because it's not natural to me. Like what is natural to me is, you know, being perfectly still and alone in a room and not speaking and just reading and writing. And I'm like, am I going to remember how to go back in the world and talk to people and interact at work? I don't know. I'm going to have to go to theater camp again, I think.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I would not have guessed that you were somebody who was like super shy. You seem so personable and chatty.
I'm a recovering shy person. Like, it's like being a recovering alcoholic. Like you're never out of it.
Right.
You're just managing the condition.
The second thing I would say is that people losing their social skills and sort of falling in love with the isolation of pandemic life is a real thing. I just read an article about this where it's actually potentially like a real problem for a lot of people who are sort of like hanging out in their room playing Xbox or just like, you know, and they're like, maybe this is just the rest of my life. You know, like I don't want to leave, you know?
I know. Yeah. That's the problem is not missing the world. The problem is, and you know, people have been like, wow, New York City is so much quieter now. It's kind of perked up a little more in the summer months, but for a couple months, everyone is saying, oh, it's so quiet, nobody's out in the street and it's so sad. And I was like, sorry, but I love it. I think it's great.
Yeah, I loved the like when the pandemic first started, it was like the first month basically in Los Angeles, the traffic was just cut in half.
Oh, yeah.
And it was awesome.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Loved it.
I know, I'm like, sorry about all the, you know, death and fear, but I can find parking right in front of my building. This is really life-changing.
No doubt.
Yeah.
So, shy kid, I'm imagining bookish. You have these creative, you have creative hippie parents. Do you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have a younger brother who lives in LA. Do you know him, Ben?
He's my next door neighbor.
I knew it. Yeah, he works in film. That guy.
The guy who works in film. Is he a screenwriter?
He is. He mostly makes his living as a film editor. He does freelance editing stuff, but he, you know, like everyone, as far as I can gather in LA, he writes films. He has done all sorts of things, sort of film adjacent.
Good for him.
And yeah, he's out there doing it. And he's lived in LA, I think, almost as long as I've lived in New York. We're a tri-coastal family, and he hates the beach. He's like, what? I don't know what he's doing there, but
I don't
talk to him. Would you get him outside? He needs some fresh air.
I don't like the beach either that much. I don't like hate the beach, but like what I always say is like it's like an ashtray. Everyone's just putting their cigarettes out in it. Yeah. Sand gets everywhere. I sound exactly
that's a real problem.
Yeah, I
beaches.
Sound like my dad, but you just get dirty. You're just like, what am I doing? I'm filthy, I got sand everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, something needs to be done about sand.
Yeah, and then like the crowds is probably the thing that I don't like the most about it. Like in the summer, you couldn't drag me to the beach in L.A. when there's like 6,000 people out there and everybody's
rushing.
And then I don't want to get too gross, but like during the pandemic, like public restrooms have basically been shut down. So like,
except for the beach.
Well, this is the thing. People go to the beach and I'm looking and all I can think is like, is everybody just pooping in the water? Is that what's happening? like
everyone, a big litter box.
That's what it is. People, because no one's using the actual facilities. People are just going out for a swim and just like, I don't even know. I don't even want to think about it, but it troubles me.
I mean, look, we go to Cape Cod every summer, and my kids, at one point, it was either last summer or the summer before, we were in the ocean, and, you know, it's all nice and idyllic, and my son just goes, so fish and whales and stuff, they're just pooping in the water, right? We're just in their poop right now, and honestly, the beach has never been the same for me since. I don't know how I never thought about that, but I was like, yeah, I guess that's right.
So
that's
much.
Right.
Yeah, so much.
We should be inside with books where it's safe. The beach is a bad idea.
The truth is that I love to swim in the ocean. I just want it to be like clean. I mean, not clean from, I you have to live with whale poop. It's going to be there, but
sure.
I just don't want like oil or like human feces if I can avoid it, you know, or like any kind of chemicals that shouldn't be there.
Very fussy. I feel like you might want a swimming pool.
Maybe.
Do you know about those?
I do.
Do you have one?
No, I wish I had one. It's like, you know, our backyard. If we had a swimming pool, we would have zero backyard. That's how small our backyard is. And so you would basically walk out the back door and like fall into the pool.
Could be fun.
Could be fun. But I don't think it's going to happen.
All right.
Let's talk about your trajectory as a writer and how this happened for you. I'm imagining that you went to some kind of school and got a liberal arts education or degree of some kind.
How dare you make that assumption about me? It's 100% true, but I could have done something else. I really always wanted to be a writer, and it's a good thing it's sort of panned out as much as it has, because it was my only idea. Like, it was the only thing I ever really wanted to do or was really super, you know, good at. That pause was me having an internal moment where I was like, don't say you're super good at writing, and then think, yes, do say that, Amy, because I'm still there mentally.
I feel
it's okay. I can say that. I think it's okay. I think I'm okay at it. But I was always writing, you know, I wrote a novel when I was 10 and a novella. Let's be fair. It was a novella, but I always knew I wanted to do it. And, in college, I studied English and literature, and I did a creative writing thesis. Somehow I talked them into letting my senior thesis be like a book of short stories about weird doppelgangers. It's like so out there. But and then I got an MFA from the University of Minnesota.
So wait, where did you go to undergrad? Did you already say?
I kind of went, it's a little complicated. I started at the University of New Mexico, and then I went to a lot of schools, and then I finished at the University of Iowa.
Why did you go to so many schools?
Listen, did my parents ask you to ask me that?
No.
I think what really happened is I wanted to take a year off, and I was like, I just want to travel and go somewhere different and see the world. And my parents were like, LOL, no, you and your brother are 4 years apart in school. This is your turn to go to college. Do you want to go or not? And I was like, oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. Let's do that. So New Mexico seemed as far away from Chicago as I could get and still be in the country. And it's such an interesting place. I don't know. I mean, surely you've been there. It's not so far from you.
Right? I've been to the University of New Mexico is in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
Okay. So when I was a freshman in college, I spent one semester in a fraternity.
Interesting.
And then we got thrown off campus. it was like this big disaster. So the only thing I ever did was I was a pledge and just got like abused for like the first semester of my college existence. And then it was over.
Just the bad part.
Yeah, but there was this thing that like we were supposed to do as pledges, if we could pull it off, where we like were supposed to kidnap two fraternity people and like take them to another chapter of the fraternity at a different school, and like
okay,
get
where,
get really drunk. I was at Boulder in Colorado.
Were you maybe in, was this the mafia?
No.
I think maybe you weren't in a fraternity.
No. So this
I think you were an organized fraternity.
So this gets better. So we organized this big party, and the whole point was that we were going to basically pretend to be drinking the whole night but stay sober. And then get everybody else really drunk, like make an extra effort to like pour like alcohol into the mouths of all these fraternity people. And we wound up renting a Ryder truck, like one of those big yellow Ryder trucks. And we like kidnapped two of these actives and like duct taped them to chairs and put them in the back of this Ryder truck. And there were like 20 of us packed into the back of this Ryder truck with a keg. And it got so bad that like they had like there had to be bathroom breaks, so like they would, you know, whoever was driving the Ryder truck would lift up the back of this thing and like 20 people would pour out. And because these guys were taped up, because we didn't want to let them go, if they got away, that was the game. If they got away, then we wouldn't succeed. So like one of these guys had to pee, but his arms were duct taped. And I remember it was like, who's gonna help this guy pee? So we had to like help them pee. It was a disaster. But,
look, you kidnap a guy, you have to help him pee. Yeah. That's part of the social construct.
This is my freshman first semester. Wow. But anyway, we went to the University of New Mexico. That was my one experience. And it was like, it was very brief. We just like showed up at this place and these guys were like, what are you guys doing here? We hadn't slept. Everyone was, you know, wasted. It was very 18 years old. But
wow.
Anyway, you're there.
I feel like you could do politics. I'm just saying, it's like you've got what it takes.
This tape will destroy my career right here.
I was in Albuquerque, not kidnapping anyone, just chilling and like reading books and going for hikes in the desert. I feel like I really missed out on some opportunities, apparently. But like my friends and I were literally like, can we talk about philosophy under this tree some more? It was pretty wild times. But yeah. And then I was like, hold on, I am really far from home. I think, you know, just felt that's pretty far. And needed to sort of, and also I feel like New Mexico is a fascinating and beautiful place, but I think it sort of didn't match the energy that I had at the time. Like it's like the place where I think 60-year-old me should move back when I'm ready to just sort of chill on a mountaintop and just like write and have like a dog with an interesting name or something. But I was like, wait, I want to be where things are happening. So, you know, Iowa City, obviously.
I was going to say.
A normal. Yeah, I was like, I need to get to the heart of it. No, then I had like a stop back in Chicago. I went back to Chicago for a little bit. And then I was like, wait. No, what I really wanted was a totally normal college experience. Like I visited a friend who lived in Iowa City and just thought, oh, this is so cute. It really feels like a college town. That would be fun. I think I was just sort of collecting experiences is the short answer to that. And in that early part of my 20s, I moved around a lot. And I don't know, I think I was just hungry for different experiences and to live in different places and do different things. And then I graduated from the University of Iowa.
I get it though. I think that's normal. I felt that way. I mean, I loved where I went to school. Like Boulder was, it matched my energy, but
I think
that is a good way to put it. And I'm thinking now about my present context, like having lived in this city for almost 20 years and starting to think like, man, I really would love some space. It would be so nice to have like a place in the country or something. I don't know if that appeals to you. Is that something that's been on? I know a lot of New Yorkers are like, maybe we should move upstate, you know?
yeah, totally. I totally get that. But I can't. I mean, I could. But I co-parent my children with my ex-husband, and we live just a couple blocks from each other. And I think that's good, and I want to keep that going. You know, it makes a lot of sense, especially in these times. The kids can walk back and forth. And so, you know, I feel like while the kids are in play, it makes sense to stay put. But I totally have had that, you know, every time and every chance I get, you know, every weekend, I have the kids. I'm like, let's drive upstate or to Staten Island. I actually love taking them for hikes in Staten Island, but places where there's just a little more space. And it just, I feel so good when I'm somewhere where there's a lot of trees and there's a lot of space. And I definitely can feel that sort of happening. And also just kind of, I don't know. Right. After a while somewhere, you're just kind of interested in a change or trying something different. But we'll see. I keep, my friends and I are always joking, and I'm not sure if we're all always joking because I'm like 70% serious. But we talk a lot about starting a all-female writers commune upstate. And it has to be, it's like in like 8 years after all our kids are out of the house. And then we're all like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have these. I think we need our own cottages. It's more of an intentional community, really. And we just write all day. Haven't figured out who's funding it. So let me know if you know of any like patrons of the arts.
GoFundMe. You could just do a GoFundMe. I'm sure people.
Yes. There you go. Here's the thing is we're tired of having jobs and we just want to write all day in the woods. I feel like it's a solid plan. Come together every night for like some sort of fun dinner party. Then go back to our own little cottages. This is the long-term plan. And I think it's a really good one.
It's so funny to hear you say that because I've had similar thoughts about like, maybe my sisters and I should like, we should pool our resources and buy like land and like land where you could build like three cottages on it so that like our family has like a homestead or a refuge. Do you know what I'm saying? Like are there all these like
weird,
creative ideas, but also like survive. There's an element of survivalism to it. Like,
right.
We need a compound. You know?
I mean, it's kind of true. There is that sort of subtext of, I was talking to a friend who lives in LA, who she was just sort of like, I'm having this feeling like climate change is really happening right in my face. And this is not a good long-term plan for me to live where I'm living. And I was like, all right, here's the thing. The commune upstate, we're not on the coast. We're far north enough. We just need to learn some skills. The one problem here is that me and my female friends who we talk about this all the time, we're all like writers and artists and live in cities and therefore don't have any actual adult human skills of any sort that could keep us alive. So we need to work on that too.
Those could be quickly learned. That's what Google is for.
Right. YouTube, I'm sure, has something about like growing stuff and I don't know.
There's a book. What's it called again? It's called the Survival Handbook, SAS. My friend sent it to me as a joke right when all this pandemic business started. He lives in Michigan and like he owns guns and it kind of like a jokey way. He's like ready for the outbreak of like civil war or something. He's always talking about militias, not in a creepy way, but just like he's ready for the end
like
times.
A fun militia.
Yeah, he's kind of like a goofy human being who like thinks that the end times could happen, and when they do, he has like this plan to escape to Canada or whatever. But he sent me that that book, which is called The Survival Handbook, which is like all you need. You can take that on the road with you, and it'll teach you how to start a fire, how to like field dress an animal, all of it.
Right, sure. I'll just get the book, and then I'll just have it, just in case.
Keep it in your bag.
Put it in a Ziploc bag, right? In my go bag, which it contains literally nothing. That's the go bag. It's just that book.
Just that book.
Yeah.
So let's get back to Iowa, which is like not a bad spot for somebody who's writerly to land. Usually people, a lot of times people on this show who went to Iowa went there for graduate school.
Right.
Were you cognizant of the writing program before you decided to go there, or was it something you learned about while you were there?
I think I just knew that it was a writery place. And sort of out of context, you know, like I didn't know anything about MFA programs or sort of how famous that program was. I was just sort of vaguely aware that it was a place where writers were. And as an undergraduate there, they have like an undergraduate workshop that I'm trying to remember how it worked. I think it's just every semester you can apply for it. And it's essentially just a writing workshop, but taught by people who are in the program, as they call it there. Like it's a cult, which I don't know, maybe MFA programs are slightly cults, but good cults. But yeah, so and I definitely became friends with a group of people who were sort of all writers and all creative people, and it was very it was a very nurturing environment to be. And then yeah. Ugh, and then I moved here in the summer of 2011.
After going to Minnesota. Or no?
So no. So right after college, I moved here to New York City in the summer of 2001 with my boyfriend at the time. And we both had temp jobs, and he had a temp job at the World Trade Center. Oh. So 9/11 was a bad moment for us. And then
he was there and he
was fine. I mean, not fine, but he was alive, obviously. So then after that, we had both lost our temp jobs and we're like, what is this place? And, you know, it was such a weird moment in New York City. Nobody knew what was going on. And then we went back to the Midwest. And then I went to graduate school at the University of Minnesota. And then it's a 3-year program. And after 3 years there, we were both sort of like, all right, let's try that New York City thing again. And then I've been here ever since.
Wow. Okay. And what about writing, like in publishing? Were there novels that you wrote that did not find their way into print that live in a drawer? Or like how did your apprenticeship and eventual like publication success unfold?
Yeah, of course there's 10 novels that are in hard drives and off floppy disks, really. I wrote 2 books in my MFA program, of a novel and a collection of short stories. And the novel I reached a point where I knew it kind of got overworked, you know, like if you ever bake things and you like overwork the pie dough or something, you're like, all right, this is never going to be the right texture now. I think that it was a book that got workshopped into oblivion, but that was like an apprenticeship novel. Like I knew I was learning how to write a book, and I came out of there with a collection of short stories and sent it to a couple of agents, and they all, you know, say the agent thing, which is like, cool, let me know when you have a novel. And so then my first book that was published was called How Far Is the Ocean From Here? And I wrote it the first couple of years I lived in New York right after graduate school, like in the mornings before work. I worked as a web editor, and I got super disciplined about it, which at the time I thought I was a total badass. And now I'm like, I didn't have children. Everything was so easy. I had so much time.
Right.
Like 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every day was mine. And that's like such a luxury, actually. And so then when that book was done, I sent it to that same agent who had said, let me know when you have a novel. I was like, did you mean that? Because now I have a novel. Hi, here it is. And weirdly, he ended up being my agent for those first 2 books. He was like the only agent that I had really talked to. And doesn't happen. Oh, his name's PJ Mark.
Okay.
He's lovely. He's at Jenklo & Nisbet now, and he's like a big deal now. And he's a lovely person. And we had like an amicable conscious uncoupling after my second book, because we were just sort of like going in different directions. And now I have a different agent named Julie Stevenson, who is, I'm going to say, a goddess. I love her so much. She has like, she worked with me so much on Unseen City, on revisions and things, in a way that I think many agents just don't do anymore. She's like a throwback, like 1920s agent, I feel like. Anyway, so the first book, it actually, yeah, weirdly kind of sold on the first round when he sent it out to his first round of editors. And then I think I was like, oh, this is how this works. Seems fine. Seems pretty easy. It's not how it works. So I just totally got lucky.
Okay. So then you get that one out into print, sold on the first round.
Yeah.
Sold another book, but I'm assuming it did not go as smoothly.
No. So that was the beginning and end of the smoothness of my publishing career. It's just been a total mess since then. But Yeah, so I actually wrote a book in between the first and second books that didn't fully work. I don't know, I should reread it because my agent was sort of like, this is not really where we want to go. And now I'm like, is it? Maybe it is. I don't know. It was a very weird book. And he was sort of like, I think that maybe you could read a book that people would like. You could write a book that people would like to read in the nicest way. He said that in the nicest way, but and I was like, interesting idea. Huh. Let me try. Maybe I could. I don't know. Let me try that. Truly had not crossed my mind. And then the second book I wrote after I'd had, like, in between when my first and second children were born. So it was really written in this really compressed amount of time in 2 years, sort of in my baby's naps. And, you know, when I did like a babysitting exchange with another mom I knew. And then when I was revising that book, so the main character in that book has two small children. And by the time I was revising it, I had had a second child and had two. And I was like, hold on, real fast, let me rewrite some of those scenes. I need to make the babies more annoying. Just kidding, I love my children, but you know, just to make it real. Yeah, and that book came out in 2013, the second book. Oh, but what I was going to say is, so the first book, it was published by an imprint that then folded, so it never came out in paperback. That editor went to a different house, as happens in publishing, you know, like they bounce all around. And
Constantly.
God bless them, they have the hardest jobs, and they do, I don't know, you know, like you'll be talking to your editor, and I just remember having a phone call with this editor who edited the first two books, and her just saying, okay, so I'm going on vacation next week, so that means I'll have time to really focus on your book. And I was like, oh man, this is
Right.
really a hard job that you have. They just have so much to do. And yeah, so then it was the same editor, but she had gone to a different publishing house. So then she acquired my second book too.
Which is called.
And it was called The Mermaid of Brooklyn, and it came out in 2013. And yeah, it's about a mom with two small children, and I was a mom with two small children, and then I was sort of horrified to find that people thought that the book was about me. I was like, what would make you think that? It's totally different. There are kids of different names. It's different. Yeah, and then I was like, well, I want to write something really, really different so that people won't do that anymore, and so that I can be really free in what I'm writing, and I want to really invent this character from scratch. And she's a 40-year-old single woman who lives in an apartment with a terrace that she's really obsessed with. It's like a really big part of the book is her apartment. And then as the book is coming out, I'll just say I'm currently a 40-year-old woman who I'm single. I live in an apartment with the terrace. It's just weird how these things happen. It's weird. For the next book, I keep saying the next book I'm going to write into existence a character who's like, I don't know, independently wealthy. She's like in amazing shape. Just like if I'm writing things into existence somehow, maybe
Lives on a commune or
I
an
should.
intentional community upstate.
That's right. Oh my God, you're right. Is super good at building fires. And like, what else do I need? Skinning squirrels or something.
It's like very handy with a crossbow, you know.
I mean, as long as you might be writing things into existence, let's make it useful, I guess.
And
Yeah.
so the sales process for The Mermaid of Brooklyn did not go on first round. I'm assuming Unseen did Unseen City. Like, you don't have to get too deep into it, but I think it's a useful conversation to have for people
Yeah.
for people listening who might be working on like a first book or who might be on the outside looking in, wondering about it. It's
Oh,
tough
totally.
for literary fiction. It's really hard, especially if you don't have some like mammoth sales record, which basically nobody does except for like four people in literary fiction.
That's right.
Uh,
Yeah.
so
Oh,
it,
it's a fucking
it,
mess.
yeah, it's hard. It's hard. And so can you talk about that? And then can you talk about how you work through it and what role maybe like a
Yeah.
persistent agent plays and the role of patience and then, you know, how like just kind of the mechanics of how it goes
Totally.
down.
Totally, yeah. And I do think it's a really useful thing for other writers and readers to hear, because you know, you kind of only hear about the, I don't don't know, big, exciting, huge deals that 22-year-old writers get and whatever. And the, for most people, it's so much more complicated. But yeah, so I think, I mean, maybe my experience is not that unusual in that I don't know if this is true. I was going to say the first book is like the easiest to sell because everybody loves a debut and you're unproven. So you don't have a sales record, but you also don't have a bad sales record. And it's just like, oh, I mean, this is also the world of publishing in what, 2006, 2007. So maybe it's totally different now. But yeah, it definitely felt like there was this willingness to just take a chance on. And that first book is pretty weird, and a pretty commercial house published it and was like, sure, I don't know, we'll try it, why not. But yeah, so then the second book, there was actually some interest in it. I talked to a couple different editors at a couple different houses, which was my only experience ever doing that, and we ended up going with the same editor from the first book. And I remember my agent was like, all right, I'm gonna have a phone call with her and say, listen, what happened with the first, because the first book kind of got orphaned at the house and all this stuff. But she had so much, she was very, really excited about the book, and she and I actually really worked well together. She's a great editor. She like gave me line notes.
What's her name?
Oh, her name's Sally Kim. She's fantastic. And I think now she's at Putnam. I've lost track of her. But she's great. I remember talking to my sort of grad school mentor, Charlie Baxter, about the editing process. And I was like, well, I just got her line notes. And he was like, you got line notes? I'm so jealous. Because it's like going to the spa for a writer, you know, to have that much attention to every little word. You're like, yes, let's get into it. Yeah, she's great. But and then I think there was kind of some enthusiasm in-house for it. And there was this moment where I think, I don't know, it was sold like at Hudson News and it got picked for this sort of Target, like, what did they call it? Emerging Writers Showcase. And like, it got a little bit of traction in a way that I think then made the eventual sales very disappointing to Simon & Schuster, like more disappointing than it would be, have been had there not been that sort of initial like interest. And I think it had a second printing and all this stuff. So the sales were, you know, not what they wanted them to be. And then they were sort of like, all right, thanks, bye. And, you know, it's so hard to get over that once you do have a sort of disappointing sales record. And it's hard to get it out of your head too as a writer, because you sort of internalize this feeling of like, is there something that I should have done that I didn't do? And really, I think it's all such a crapshoot. I don't think even publishers know like what makes a big book a big book. They know what to do. They know what to try, but even that doesn't always work.
You know, I've had this conversation with myself, maybe in like that self-critical mind that isn't necessarily always that helpful. Like, yeah. Tell me if you've ever had this conversation with yourself where you're like, maybe the noise that I'm making just isn't loud enough, or maybe the music that I'm playing is just like, it's just for a few people. It's just not for a wide audience. I'm just not one of those people who resonates with a lot of people or who has that magic. I don't have the magic. Do you ever have that conversation with yourself?
Oh yeah, totally. Totally. And I think that, and I don't know, just the way publishing works is, I feel like encourages that sort of, like in a way we all know that as much as one person, and as much as you try to sort of be like the A student writer, be like, okay, I'm going to do all the things they want me to do. And I'm going to have a social media presence and I'm going to, you know, go do readings, and none of that stuff. It's fun to do. And it's really, really great to connect with readers. I feel like that is sort of the best part of having a book out. But does it move the needle in terms of book sales? No. And they know that, and you know that. And really, you know, there's things that, especially if it's like a big five publisher, there are things that they can do that they do for some books and that they don't do for others, you know, and certain media placements and, you know, certain like levers they can pull that they choose to or they choose not to. And if they choose not to, I feel like fine, but then it's just unfortunate that then as a writer you sort of internalize that. Like, oh, I didn't do a good enough job, just the book wasn't good enough, or you know, there was no publicity, but still people, you know, there's so many great books are published every year. How are people gonna find your book if it's not anywhere?
Right.
You know?
Or like, I just don't have the soul. Like something to do with my soul, right, is just not big enough or resonant enough. I've thought about that. Like there's something fundamentally wrong with the core of me. but here, let's.
Well, I think that's like.
Well, I want to just make ourselves feel better for just a moment, because I can imagine. I have not lived this, but I can imagine that if you are one of those lucky few writers who has some mega success, where like your book is like, you know, sprinkled with fairy dust and like it goes on to sell a bajillion copies, I can imagine the pressure that you must feel on subsequent books to make sure the magic doesn't go away, to prove you're not a flash in the pan. You know what I'm saying? I can that then you just have that psychological problem. So
yeah. At least I don't have that. Yeah. No, I do think that's another real head game. Like there's no way to not do this and be in some sort of weird headspace, I think. And you have to have that weird combination of sort of, I think that every artist has, I don't know, a weird amount. You have to have enough ego that you're like, yes, this thing I'm creating is people should look at it and everyone should look at it and everyone should love it. And for me, that goes exactly hand in hand with thinking, oh God, this is so horrible. I can't believe anyone is, I'm wasting people's time with this. It's so embarrassing. And both of those things are equally powerful, you know? And they don't seem to contradict each other. Like they just live side by side. And then with this book, with Unseen City, it went through such a long process. You know, my agent looked at an early draft and said, I don't know what to do with this. You know, I think that everyone would have liked it had I been able to be sort of a commercial, sort of upmarket commercial women's fiction writer, which is something that I think is great. I'm just like, for whatever reason, every book I write is, I feel like they're all totally different, and I just have to keep myself interested by kind of taking some creative risks, and I just like don't have it in me to be the kind of writer that I think earlier in my career sort of people wanted me to be. Not that there's anything wrong with being that kind of writer, I just like couldn't figure out how to do it. Like it's just not what I can do. And this book is, I think, more literary. It sort of is, I don't know, there's things about it that so I had to sort of like start from scratch, look for a new agent, sort of think about, is this worth it? Is this book worth it? Should I just scrap it and start over again as I've done before? And then I had actually worked with Julie on a children's book that I wrote that she tried to help me publish. And that too was sort of two in between genres to find a home. And then the same thing sort of happened with Unseen City. So she was, you know, trying to sell this book that's sort of a cross of genres, which I feel like I love as a reader, and I think other readers love, but I think marketing departments of publishing houses hate, because it's hard to talk about what is it. Is it historical? Is it supernatural? Is it literary fiction? Is it funny? Is it sad? What is it? And then that plus knowing that I sort of have this bad sales record. And Julie, okay, so she went through a huge revision with me. She is amazing. She gave me like notes completely in my love language, where she was like, do you think that, I feel like you're too worried about plot, and I think that you can do this thing with language and character, and you should just do that. Just go there. Just be as weird as you want to be. I was like, I love you so much. Thank you. So then, like, I'm not even sure I totally understand what this means, but the note we got from a lot of editors was, I liked this book, but I can't tell if it's commercial or literary, and I don't know how I would sell it, which I know what that means, and I don't know what that means, but, and honestly, it took a year. All of the persistence and grit was entirely on Julie's side. You know, there were times when I was like, let's just forget it. But she really believed in this book in a way that I didn't after a certain point. And then, yeah, Red Hen Press took it. And Julie sort of said, this is the perfect home for this book because they're an indie press, but they're a big indie press. And reading the Red Hen Press catalog, I feel like it totally feels like my literary home. You know, every book they publish, I'm like, yes, this is my kind of book. I love this book. And they've been delightful to work with. It's like being welcomed into a family, which feels extremely different than, you know, commercial publishing. But
where it's like, you know, you feel cool for like a week and then they're like, done, on to the next. It's like over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I will never forget with my first book having a conversation with the very sweet, like, you know, 12-year-old publicist who was assigned to my book. And, you know, it was my first novel and I was so, I don't know, just what can I do? And I remember talking to her the week the book came out. So it was an imprint of Crown, and she was doing, I think, publicity for like Olive Crown or something. And she said, I know, I'm so sorry. I've been so busy with Pat Buchanan's book this week that I just don't have a lot of wavelength for your book. And I was just like, what the hell? Like, knowing that I'm sure whatever Pat Buchanan's book was, you know, paid my advance, you know, like, I get that that's how commercial publishing works, but still, it's just so demoralizing when you're like a pure of heart fiction writer. And you're like, here's my special little novel.
Right. Well, you know, I think there's like lessons. I say this a lot on this show, but it only takes one. Like, you can That's go true. Through all sorts of rejection. You can have to sit around and be patient and wait for a while. You know, there's all sorts of different ways that this happens. But ultimately, It takes like an agent who believes a lot of times.
Yeah.
It takes persistence on the part of the author, and it takes a publisher who believes as well. And your book has been getting great reviews, you know, and it's out in the world. It's published beautifully. To the average person who picks it up, they have no idea that there's all this backstory. That's all that matters.
Right.
And, you know, I don't mean to say that like a good review or any kind of review validates or invalidates the merits of a creative work, but it's a lesson, you know, it's a lesson that, you know, there might be these big publishers who have financial pressures that they're dealing with that force them into, you know, judgments or decision-making processes that really don't have, and at the end of the day, anything to do with the inherent quality of a work.
Right.
You know, it's also subjective. And I think that, you know, the way that I, or the place that I try to wind up in after I go through all these like mental gymnastics is just find a way to shut yourself off from the world and just do your work. Just do your work.
That's right. That's like, right.
That's it.
That's right. And your work is the writing. And it's hard to remember that sometimes, but your work is the writing and is the book. And then someone else's job is to publish it, and they're good at their jobs and they'll do that part. And then it really does help to have like someone in your corner. For me, it's my agent, who's just like, you're doing great. Everything's okay. This poor woman, she's so amazing. She's like part therapist in a way that I think a lot of agents are. You know, she has to field like texts and emails that are like, oh, is this okay? And she's like, it's good. But she can, you know, it's like someone who is a little bit of removed from it can have sort of more faith in the work than when it's so close to you, kind of.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah. And just to say, I'm so grateful to the Nervous Breakdown for making it a book club pick. I've already heard from a couple readers who read it that way and just felt like moved and reached by the book in some way, which is the best. I mean, that's the best. It's the only reward, truly. And it's just the best. And it all weirdly feels like it's kind of for the best, because this is a just weirdly apt historical moment for this book to be existing in. And I just feel like all of these things aligned in a weird way.
That's awesome. Well,
so thanks for that.
Yeah, no, it's our pleasure. Happy to shine a light on it. It's great to talk with you and to get to know you a little better. I was going to tell you this at the top of the show, but it's a good place to end. Like, you have a mark of distinction as the first guest on this show who I mistakenly thought had already been on the show. Like, that's how many so many podcasts I've done. Like, I feel like because we, I think we published you at the Nervous Breakdown years ago.
You've been
in my like digital orbit, and I was like, oh yeah, I've talked to Amy before. We're going to have her back on. And then like, I was like looking through the archives. So I was like, where's Amy's episode? And I was like, oh my God, I haven't talked to her.
Like, we deleted it because it's so bad. Whoops.
I'm just, you know, it's a premature senility. But I was like, you know, for some reason, I thought we had already talked and knew each other. But
that's really funny.
It's delightful actually talk with you.
Yes, you too. And I feel like, right, like I've been a part of the Nervous Breakdown extended family for such a long time. I feel like it's like, yeah, when I was allowed to write on the Nervous Breakdown, I was so excited. I was like, I've made it in the literary internet. I love the Nervous Breakdown.
Well, it's
I always say, still be here.
It's a nice, I think if the site has anything going for it, I mean, aside from longevity, it's been around for almost like more than 15 years now, I think, or almost 15 years I think the name of it, like it's grown into its name. I feel like the cultural moment that we're in now. Yeah,
that's right. Oh my God. And sorry. Do you know about the weirdest Nervous Breakdown Unseen City coincidence of all, which is that, so Kimberly Weatherall,
sure,
if I'm saying her name right, she was an editor for the Nervous Breakdown, right? And a contributor and great Nervous Breakdown person. So she narrated half of the audiobook of Unseen City. Did you know this?
No.
Isn't that bananas?
Well, she has a theater background or some sort of acting
she
background.
She does, yeah. Yeah, and now she does audiobooks. And it felt like a perfect, I don't know, like full circle early aughts internet moment to have her be narrating the audiobook. Like, of course, it's just, we're all helping each other out here.
That's how it happens.
But yeah, she's so great.
Awesome. Well, Amy, congrats again. And do you have anything else that you're working on? I mean, I don't mean to put, I know you're supposed to just enjoy, hopefully, the publication of this one, but writers are always writing. Do you have another book in the works?
Yes, I do. I have so many books in the works. There's a novel that my agent has now that is done, maybe, if she tells me it's done. That in theory would be the next book. It's an epistolary novel about a novelist who sort of disappeared, and then somebody is trying to find her again, see if she's still alive, and sort of bring her back into the world.
Not autobiographical.
No, she's a genius, universally beloved. I used my imagination. And then the character who's trying to sort of find her is a young sort of hungry web editor. Also nothing like me. I use my imagination completely all the time. God. And so there's that. There's a nonfiction book that I've sort of been pretending to write for a long time about extremely long-term projects that is becoming its own extremely long-term project. So I'm just going to pretend that that's part of the thing is that it's supposed to take forever to write, because it is taking forever to write.
What's that one? What's the nonfiction?
Well, so sometimes I call it the long haul, and sometimes I call it how to keep going. And I think that there's like two versions of it, and I still don't know which version is going to kind of win out. There's like one version of it that's just about extremely long-term projects and sort of how people keep going with them. And I've done a ton of research and written two chapters of it. One is about Dorothy Richardson. Do you know her? She's this modernist novelist who wrote like a 12-volume book over the course of 70 years or whatever. She's nuts.
That's great. I think those kinds of projects are awesome. And I'm thinking like
fun, right?
Richard Linklater just popped into my head. Like those time movies. Like I feel like those are such cool projects.
Right, Boyhood. Yeah, right. Right. But then I got so excited about them and started spinning out. And that book, the notes for that book would be, you know, 10,000 pages long if I wrote it, about all the different long-term projects I got excited about. So I'm still trying to sort of focus it. But more recently I've been thinking maybe it's more like, here, you tell me which one to write. Maybe the version of it that makes more sense is the how to keep going version, which is more sort of reader focused and sort of I think more fragmented and sort of take lessons from all of these different long-term project people. and sort of more about how the reader can sort of keep going. Like, how do you keep going? And I feel like it with a really long, open-ended creative project, but also just in this moment in time when the future feels uncertain, like, how do you keep making things? I don't know, which book do you want to read?
I mean, I'm going to cheat and say like some sort of melding of the two, you know. I think the kind of book you're describing, there's often like a really cool way to do a braided narrative.
Yeah.
And I think I always love it when there's an interweaving of the personal with the third party, you know, where you're talking about your own personal interest in this or struggles with this, and then you're looking to heroes or heroines who serve as examples, you know, like Dorothy or Richard Linklater, whoever it is, you know,
right.
And that would be my suggestion. I think.
Okay, I wrote that down.
Yeah, I don't know. If we can have a little Amy in there, like just Amy, like unadorned, just like, this is me, this is why I'm here.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
But, I don't know if anyone wants that, but okay. All right, I'll write it and I'll send it to you and tell me what you think.
Okay, deal.
This really simplifies things. I really appreciate that. I couldn't figure it out.
So glad we got that settled.
Your political career and my next book. This has been really productive.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Well, such a pleasure to meet you over the line here and to talk with you. Congratulations on Unseen City. Best of luck with all that you have going. And I will now let you go be a mom.
Oh, good. I don't know if they've had lunch yet. Let's find out. All right. Thank you so much. This is so much fun.
All right, folks. That is Amy Schoen. Her novel is called Unseen City. It is available now from Red Hen Press. You can find Amy online at amyschoenwrites.com. You can follow her on Twitter. Her handle over there is @AmySchoen. She's also got an Instagram and a Facebook. And she's on Goodreads. She's all over the place. Amy Schoen. And the novel is once again Unseen City. Go get your copy immediately. If you would like to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. If you want to send in one of your Where I Listen photos, you can include a selfie if you want. Or not. #WhereIListen. You can also DM the photos on Twitter @OtherPPL or on Instagram @OtherPPL.podcast. The Other People podcast is offered freely. Every single episode of this show is available for free, folks. More than 670 episodes and counting. If you like the program, if you listen regularly and you have the means, throw a couple of bucks in the hat over at patreon.com/OtherPPLpod. patreon.com/OtherPPLpod. Don't forget about Other People gear. Just go to the show's website, otherppl.com, click on the t-shirt in the left sidebar. This program also has its own app, the Other People with Brad Listy app. It, too, is free. It's a free app. It's a good app. It's a high-quality app. Go get the app. My blog, the address is bradpocalypse bradpocalypse.blogspot.com bradpocalypse.blogspot.com if that is interesting to you. Next week on the program, I can't say yet. I'm still not organized. How depressing is it that Ruth Bader Ginsburg died? God damn it. I can't even think about it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just too much. It's all too much. I'm going to get up. I know you're supposed to fight, but, you know, fuck.